So we have been seeing the last couple of classes how Sabbath keepers begin to, as we say, come out of the woodwork, because by now we are coming to the end of that 1260 years in which they would have to be in the wilderness, which began, again, depending on how you count it, sometime in the 300s around the Council of Nicaea, or certainly no later than the imperial restoration of Justinian in the 500s. So we're coming into that time where Sabbath keepers will be able to become known. They have lived in hiding, in seclusion, in rural areas, in the mountains and in the valleys, all the way from northern Turkey through southeastern Russia and Europe, on into Italy, northern Italy, Switzerland, over into Spain in some cases. There have been little enclaves of Sabbath keepers throughout time, sometimes very, very small in number. And when they grew large, almost without exception, the Catholic Church found some way to persecute them, bring them back into the Catholic Church, or drive them into another region, or cause them to go deeper in hiding, or whatever. But through the 1400s, we begin to come to that period of time we know in history as the Renaissance. University learning was becoming more available. Students were studying at the famous universities of the world, now being formed, or already having been formed in some cases. Thinkers were coming along. There was a liberal trend, to use the term, although to us now today, the liberals of this time would be arch-conservatives, but they were liberal thinkers in that day, coming out of the Sorbonne in Paris primarily, which was the cradle of that kind of learning. Printing had come along, as we've noted. In the 1400s, the Bible was the book most often being printed and being distributed, now available in the common languages of the people. So people were beginning to read it. Luther breaks from the Catholic Church in Germany, Calvin in Switzerland, Knox in Scotland. Wesley begins the movement that became the Methodists in England. Things are moving, in other words, through this period of time. And in this setting, then, God's church is going to be able to rise in England. We have seen how it existed in Hungary and up into Russia. Again, in very small numbers, but there is at least minimal documentation on the Sabbath keepers there. We certainly trust they are God's church. We know of no other, put it that way, Sabbath keepers. But they were not to spread the gospel of the kingdom of God to the world at that time. They did their best with what they had to do with, but primarily they only worked within very small geographic regions, and then not very many. In the early part of the 1500s, Henry VIII in England led England in a break from the Roman Catholic Church, an unheard-of move for the king to do this, but you may remember the story in history. Henry had more than one wife. He wanted to divorce and remarry, and the Catholic Church refused to acknowledge his freedom to do so. So he pulled the Catholic churches and the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was the head of that church, out into his own church. He became the head of the church. So the sovereign of England, even to this day, is the head of the Church of England. It is generally regarded as being presided over by the Archbishop of Canterbury, however. But the Queen today is, nominally at least, the head of that organization. England vacillated back and forth through the 1500s. It was a time of turmoil in England as she was finding herself. But finally, later in the century, when Elizabeth I takes the throne, England is firmly and has forevermore been established in the Protestant realm. It did revert back to Catholicism between Henry and Elizabeth. It was Mary, Queen of Scots, wasn't it, that led them back into the Catholic Church? You English students. Was it? One of the Marys, anyway, I think it was. Anyway, that was occurring during that time. By the time we come to the 1600s, King James is on the throne. And during that time, the Bible is translated into English as we know it. Remember, it had already been translated into English some little time back by Wycliffe. So the people had it available, but if you ever see a Wycliffe Bible at the British Museum and other places, you may see at least copies of it. Do we have one in our own library? A copy of the Wycliffe Bible? I don't know if we do or not, in our rare book section. You will not be able to read it, I almost assure you. The script and the terminology are like ancient English, more akin to Low German, in fact, than it would be to English as you'd read through it. But the King James edition that you're so familiar with came into existence, and now people had it available. And so it is in this setting that Sabbath keepers can begin to flourish in England. It isn't easy for them. The State Church of England is, in its own way, about the same as the Catholic Church would be in another country. Maintain very strict and rigid control over all religious activity, and remains that way to this day. Very difficult for religious organizations to flourish in most countries of the world. America is an exception, Canada, certainly Australia, but even those two countries lesser so than in the United States, a country founded basically upon the principles of freedom of religion, as we'll see in a moment. Some of the reference works, or a couple of them that I'll be using mostly as we go through today's time, is a work that I've already cited called Jones's Church History. We have used it before, and a few comments from it. And the other, Joseph Belcher, B-E-L-C-H-E-R, a book called The Religious Denominations in the United States. The Religious Denominations in the United States by Belcher. This book, I think, written in the 1800s, but does give us a great deal of information about Sabbath keepers in colonial America and back to England. In Jones's Church History, and I'll just read some comments now for a while to you from these references, noting which are which, but just read them word for word because they tell the story, I think, of what was happening. From Jones, Chambers' Encyclopedia states that in England, many conscientious and independent thinkers in the reign of Elizabeth, that's 1558 to early 1600s, in the reign of Elizabeth, many conscientious and independent thinkers advocated the seventh day. So there were people who now, with access to the Bible, really for the first time, read it, found that it said you should keep the seventh day holy, and decided that's what they should do. These weren't by the millions, but there were significant numbers of them. He says that in 1595 there was a book published about that, as early as 1595. That's Belcher, excuse me. I'm shifting to Belcher now. And here's what he says. The Sabbath controversy commenced in England near the close of the 16th century. One Nicholas Bound, Doctor of Divinity, of Norton in the county of Suffolk, published a book in 1595 in which he advanced the modern notion concerning the Christian Sabbath. That is a perpetuation of the Sabbath of the fourth commandment, but that the day specified on the commandment has been changed by divine authority from the seventh to the first day of the week. This doctrine was very taking, proclaimed as it was at this time when there was felt to be so much need for greater strictness regarding the day of rest. According to a learned writer of that age, in a very little time it became the most bewitching error and the most popular infatuation that was ever embraced by the people of England. So that's a pretty powerful statement. Dr. Bound's book was suppressed by order of the Archbishop Whitgift in 1599, but its suppression only led to the publication of a multitude of other works in which every variety of opinion was expressed. While this discussion was in progress, several advocates of the seventh day arose who vindicated its claim with great boldness and ability. So he noted that the authority to change the church, to change the day, was not there, and it should not have been changed. And got himself in trouble for it, as many did. England at this time still was not what it was to become, relevant to tolerance, and it is again today even very difficult there. In 1618, there was a Sabbath-keeping minister by the name of John Traske, T-R-A-S-K-E. John Traske or Trask, I'm not sure which way it should be pronounced. John Traske began to speak and write in favor of the seventh-day Sabbath about the time that the Book of Sport for Sunday was published, under the direction of the Archbishop of Canterbury and King James I. See, they were trying to clamp down on Sunday and make people more rigidly observe the Sabbath, or that is Sunday, they call it the Sabbath, in England. Now here is a book that appears at about the same time England is trying to tighten up regulations on Sunday keeping, of a man who's writing in favor of the seventh-day Sabbath in 1618. He took high ground as to the sufficiency of the Scripture to direct in religious services and the duty of the state to impose nothing contrary to the Word of God. For this, he was brought before the Star Chamber, where a long discussion was held respecting the Sabbath, in which Dr. Andrews, Bishop of Winchester, took a prominent part. Trasky was not turned from his opinion, but received a censure from the Star Chamber. Paget's heresiography says that he was sentenced on account of his being a Sabbatarian to be set upon the pillory at Westminster, and from thence to be whipped to the Fleet Prison, there to remain a prisoner for 3 years. Well, that's what Sabbath keeping got you in 1618 in England, whipped at the post and sent to the prison for 3 years. Mrs. Trasky, his wife, lay in Maiden Lane at the gatehouse for 15 years, where she died for the same crime. They put her under house arrest, kept her at a not regular prison, but in a gatehouse, and kept her there for 15 years. She died, we don't know at what age. Skipping to 1628, continuing in Belcher's work, Theophilus Bradbourne, a learned minister of the gospel in the established church, wrote a book which was printed in London in 1628, wherein he argued that the Lord's Day is not the Sabbath day by divine institution, but that the seventh-day Sabbath is now in force. This book, not having been replied to, he published another one in 1632, entitled, A Defense of That Most Ancient and Sacred Ordinance of God, the Sabbath Day. That sounds like the way a British would write a book about the Sabbath, the title. For this he was called to account before the Lord Archbishop of Canterbury and the Court of High Commission. Several lords of His Majesty's private council and many other persons of quality were present as his examination. So God was at least bringing the Sabbath day before the highest people in the land in the 1600s. England had an opportunity. God's church was, as it were, coming out of hiding, especially in England now, and Sabbath keepers were brought before the highest religious officials of the land, and secular too. For some reason, whether from being overawed by the character of that assembly or from fearing the consequences of rejecting its overtures, it is not possible now to say. He went back to the embrace of the established church. So here was a man who presented a defense for the Sabbath before the archbishop and a learned council. And it appears in writing that he at least must have recanted of his way and went back into the Sabbath church. He did, however, continue to maintain that if the Sabbatic institution be indeed moral and perpetually binding, then his conclusion that the seventh day ought to be kept is necessary and irresistible. But he just didn't know what to do. He may not have been one of God's ministers, but at least it was being brought before them. Continuing with Belcher, about this time we find Philip Tandy, another name. Most of these names I wouldn't hold you for except to be able to recognize, associate them with what they are. I wouldn't ask you to write a treatise on them, no more than I'm giving you. But you'd recognize the names. Philip Tandy, T-A-N-D-Y, promulgating the same doctrine concerning the Sabbath in the northern part of England. He was educated in the established church, of which he became a minister. Having changed his views respecting the mode of baptism and the day of the Sabbath, he abandoned that church and became a mark for many shots. He had several important disputes about his peculiar sentiments and did much to propagate them. Skipping to 1642, a man named James Ockford, O-C-K-F-O-R-D, James Ockford, was another early advocate of the Sabbath in England. He seems to have been well acquainted with the discussions in which Trask and Bradburn were engaged. Being dissatisfied with the pretended conviction of Bradburn, he wrote a book in defense of Sabbatarian views entitled The Doctrine of the Fourth Commandment. This book, which must have been published in about the year 1642, was burned by the authorities of the established church. One Caudry, a Presbyterian and a member of the Assembly of Divines, fearing that this sharp refutation by fire would be complained of a harsh dealing, wrote a review of it, which in 1854 was still extant. That is a review of that book written by Ockford. The book and the review are now lost. So all we have are these secondary, sometimes third-hand information about this time. Several causes combined to prevent the early organization of Sabbatarian churches in England. The various laws passed to secure uniformity in worship and to hinder the holding of religious meetings among all dissenters from the established church were doubly oppressive on those who observed the Sabbath on a different day from the mass of Christians. To this and similar causes, we must attribute the fact that there were no churches regularly organized until about 1650. So even though we have Sabbath-keeping ministers, some of them coming out of the Anglican church, we know of no churches prior to 1650. Within 50 years of that period, however, there were 11 Sabbatarian churches. besides many scattered Sabbath keepers in different parts of the kingdom. And next class, I'll have a little map reproduced for you I have here. We hadn't had this available. I mean, I hadn't found it for duplicating, but it'll be available next time. By the way, you may have heard, many of you are in the class, I was able to get through our section in prophecy and not have class Monday. Unfortunately, I have enough material that we must have class on Tuesday to finish the thought. Hope that won't bother you. But I will have a handout showing you the locations of those churches in England. These churches were located in Braintree and Essex, and I won't read them because they're just a number of cities scattered throughout the country. And you'll see them there. And there were three churches in London at this time. 11 churches throughout England, three of them being located in the city of London. The most prominent of which was the Mill Yard Church. There was another called the Cripplegate Church and the Pinner's Hall Church. You don't need to write those down because it'll be on the map. Under the care of Mr. Belcher, whose funeral sermon, preached by Joseph Stinnett, April 1, 1695, now lies before us. Eight of these churches have now become extinct. This is another Belcher writing later, probably an ancestor of his who was a member of that church. The one died in 1695. Eight of them in 1850-something had become extinct. Hence, a complete account of them cannot be obtained. Unfortunately, the buildings of those churches no longer exist either, which is a little bit unusual in England because sometimes buildings last for, you know, many, many centuries. I will refer you to a couple of works to study this period of time even a little more. I think I mentioned way back at the beginning of the year, about the time Mr. Armstrong was coming in contact with the truth, in the late 20s and in the 30s, the two most prominent ministers of the Church of God Seventh Day were Andrew Duggar and C.O. Dodd. They wrote a book called A History of the True Church. A History of the True Church by Duggar and Dodd. That book is still available through the Seventh Day Church of God publishing houses and other sources. Not too easy to obtain, but the bookstore can help you get it if you would like it. As I mentioned way back at the beginning of the semester, we do not regard that book as authoritative, but it is a good source, and it's certainly good reading material. Its conclusions, I think, sometimes are a little bit too much based upon possibility rather than fact, but at least it is available and is a good source to trace history, pretty much like we have done it in this class all the way through. So you could get that. There is a book written by a man who used to be a member of this church, but I think after leaving it in the middle 1970s, affiliated with the Church of God Seventh Day, and I wouldn't normally recommend such a work, but he has done a good source work on writing a book about the Seventh-day Church of God in America. His name is Richard Nichols, and his book is entitled A History of the Seventh-day Church of God. I don't offhand know how to obtain a copy of that, except that he himself has a mailing address and does mail it out for a small amount of money. I would assume the library, the bookstore, can help you with that if you ever would want your own copy. It's not interesting reading, but he does have a lot of documented little, a lot of names. And Mr. So-and-so and Sister So-and-so did this in Oklahoma in 17, whatever it was. And he's got a lot of information from the churches. Little church congregations here and there of the Church of God Seventh Day. And it's not a bad source to have available to you. Continuing, though, with Belcher's work, relevant to the churches in England then, just wanted to mention those other sources for you because we don't have time to go through most of that. The Mill Yard Church, Belcher wrote, is located in the eastern part of London. The time of its origin is not certainly known. The records now in possession of the church, this was in the 1850s, reach back as far as 1673. But as they contain no account of its organization and refer to another book which has been previously used, it is possible that the church dates from a considerably earlier period. We think it safe to put down John James as the first pastor of Mill Yard. On the 19th day of October 1661, while Mr. James was preaching, an officer entered the place of worship, pulled him down from the pulpit, led him away to the police under strong guard. About 30 members of the congregation were taken before a bench of justice, then sitting at a tavern in the vicinity, where the oath of allegiance was tendered to each. And those who refused it were committed to Newgate Prison. Mr. James himself was examined and committed to Newgate upon the testimony of several profligate witnesses who accused him of speaking treasonable words against the king. Sounds like what happened to Jesus. Treason against the king. We'd probably be accused of that. We preach another government. Loyalty to that higher government. But we don't treat treason to this government, nor did I assume this man. His trial took place about a month afterward, at which he conducted himself in a manner to awaken much sympathy. He was, however, sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered. This awful sentence did not dismay him in the least. He calmly said, "Blessed be God, whom man condemns, God justifies." While he lay in prison under sentence of death, many persons of distinction visited him, who were greatly affected by his piety and resignation. At the scaffold on the day of his execution, Mr. James addressed the assembly in a very affectionate manner. Having finished his address, he knelt down, thanked God for his covenant mercies, and prayed for the witnesses against him, for the executioner, for the people of God, for the removal of division, for the coming of Christ, for the spectators, and for himself, that he might enjoy a sense of God's favor and entrance into glory. Then, having thanked the sheriff for his courtesy, he said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit," and was immediately launched into eternity. That's what Belcher says. It's hard to believe the British people would do such a thing. It seems so barbaric, but that's the way it was. The Americans did it too, and I guess everybody else did it. This is not cruelty, and this kind of thing is not exclusive to any one people. Gruesome. After he was dead, his heart was taken out and burned. His quarters were affixed to the gates of the city. His head was set aside Whitechapel at a pole opposite to the alley in which the meeting house stood. So not always easy to be a Sabbath keeper. Jones, on this same subject, says, of the Mill Yard Church, "John Trask and John James were the founders of the Mill Yard Church, probably between 1616 and 1661. He says, however, Belcher said something slightly different. Jones thought, in 1546, there were seven congregations in London which called themselves collectively the Poor Despised Churches of God. 16 years later, 1661, John James, the founder of one of the Sabbath-keeping churches in London, died a martyr's death for the precious truth, showing the severity of persecutions against these despised people of God. Francis Bainfield, writing 16 years later, that's 1677, says, "The Church of God, there were two Sabbath-keeping churches in London. Francis Bainfield, included the Mill Yard Church with two other churches by mentioning a public debate it was then carrying on in defense of the Sabbath against opposers of this truth. At least three of these seven, quote, despised churches of God, end quote, were in London in 1646 and survived the persecutions which cost the death of John James and others that were functioning still in the year 1677. Also, Francis Bainfield's church moved to the Mill Yard Church to hold their services in 1830. Francis Bainfield, author of a book in 1677, in which he brings out evidence to show the Church of God of that day, like the Sabbath, is a continuation of the Church of God of the Old Testament, which is exactly what this work has done, except that it brings the church down to 1935. That is the work of the author now writing. So, you see what was happening. Belcher continuing then, "Only three Sabbatarian churches now remain in England, out of the 11 which existed there 150 years ago. Their decline has been gradual, but certain and unchecked. Sufficient causes for it may be assigned. There can be little doubt that the observance of the Sabbath upon a different day from the one commonly observed is connected with greater inconveniences than result from embracing the peculiar doctrines of any other Christian denomination. It would not be very surprising, therefore, if in England the number of Sabbath keepers should gradually diminish." Of course, this is 1850. By that time, the establishment of Sabbath keepers was long since established in America, as we'll see, and the Sabbath-keeping movement was primarily now centered out of the American colonies. But they still existed in England. There had been influence at work in the churches themselves, exactly adapted to produce the results which they witnessed. From a very early period, it had been the practice of Sabbatarian preachers to accept the pastoral care of first-day churches, thus attempting to serve two masters at once, and thus particularly proclaiming a low estimate of the doctrine by which they were distinguished. So, you know, this was a time of weakness. God is describing this church as one who has a name but is dead, who is living but dead. So they were not able to do the work in the same way, that it was going to happen at a later time. And whether these were all true ministers of Christ, you know, who can say? We were merely showing the history of the Sabbatarian movement during that period of time. Now, of course, Protestantism was on the rise now throughout all these years. You have the development of several Protestant churches. And as a result of the Waldensian Anabaptist movement, there were groups of very rigid, non-Catholic, non-Church of England groups that were formed and that were not Church of God either. Perhaps the most prominent and influential that would in certain ways have some bearing upon how God's church could come to America would have been, first of all, those early American colonialists we know as Puritans, who, coming out of England to escape persecution, settled in Holland, but were equally persecuted there, and in the early part of the 1600s began the migration to the colonies in the New World, establishing at Plymouth Rock, and what was that, 1621? I didn't write down the date. You early American historians. I think it was in the 1620s, if I remember correctly, anyway. When the pilgrims first set foot in America, there were a very religious group of people. Now, there is some theory that on the Mayflower there were a couple of Sabbath keepers, but it is not documentable. So I'll only mention it as a possibility. But if you're ever back in New England, and you will surely, when you go there, visit Plymouth Rock as a tourist to see where the first colonial Americans began to establish the colonies. You can see the historical monuments and things that are there. It is interesting to read the material about what was happening there. But there is no documentable evidence, but there are some among the Seventh-day Baptists who claim that there were a couple of Sabbath keepers on board the very first boat that brought settlers to stay in the New World, at least in the American colonies, that is, to begin to establish the religious freedom. Along with them to escape persecution came Quakers, Methodists, Baptists, Anabaptists, and of all things, Catholics, who were fleeing the persecution of the Protestants in Germany, Switzerland, and in England. And so among the colonialists, you find them congregating in areas largely based upon their religious preferences. So in Massachusetts, the Catholic colony was firmly established. In Pennsylvania, the Quakers, the Methodists, and I don't remember what territory, Baptists, of course, there too. And some of these other people began to establish themselves and to build their new little colonies and cities in the 1600s during that period of time. And it was in this atmosphere of very strict religious regulation that when they established their own colonies in the New World, they then established a rather harsh and dictatorial policy for anyone else who might live among them. People were welcome to come and live among them, but they had to practice the dogma of that particular denomination. It's interesting to note that in the history of America, when the Puritans were establishing the colonies there, that Christmas celebration was forbidden in the colonies as a pagan festivity. And it was not until a great number of German colonialists came in with their festivity of the Christmas season that it was in large enough numbers established to overcome any of the strict Puritan tradition that had forbidden it for some years in the early part of the establishment of the country. It's hard for most people to believe that, but there are a number of books you can read about those kind of things. I'll just mention one as an example. There's a book called Puritanism in the Old World and in the New. You don't need to be responsible for that in a test. Puritanism in the Old World and the New, written by Gregory, in which he goes through some of those things and shows the influences of how those people came. Now, we would not associate any of these earliest settlers by any means with Sabbath keepers. We have no evidence of any of them being, although there are a couple of, as I said, traditions. And maybe among them would have been, you know, a tiny little handful seeking religious freedom. It was not until the 1670s, that the colonies begin to establish a church in the New World of Sabbath keepers. 1671 is the date of the establishment of the church, the first Sabbath-keeping church in America. 1671. It was established by a man named Stephen Mumford, M-U-M-F-O-R-D. Stephen Mumford, he arrived in the American colonies in 1664. And was a Sabbath keeper from England. 1664. And he establishes his residence in and around the area of Providence, Rhode Island. Now, we can trace the history and get more information about this from the modern-day organization of the Seventh-day Baptists. In the course of time, Sabbath keepers grew quite rapidly in the American colonies, in fact, and had an association one with another. They worked in and out and around some of the Protestant groups as the development of religion in the American colonies was moving, but it was there were splits and rifts and difficulties within the Sabbath-keeping movement almost like any other. Like the Lutheran Church in America has been divided into several different synods and groups. They sometimes try to get back together, and a few of them do, and then another one splits off. And so it was among Sabbath-keepers in the colonies that they began to split off in the course of time. I think it was later before there were any major splits. But at any rate, in the early 1800s, the Seventh-day Baptists become the dominant, at that time, Sabbath-keeping church. They gain possession, legally, of the documents and the historic records and the buildings and properties of the Sabbath-keeping churches in the colonies, in the eastern seaboard. So they are the custodians, if you please, of the knowledge that we have available to us about Seventh-day churches in America. In Providence, Rhode Island, this church still exists. This first Sabbath-keeping church established in 1671. It is on the National Historic Register. It is a museum. It's well worth your taking the time to go to if you're ever in and around the Boston area. It's not a long drive down to Providence. And it's well worth taking your time to go see. If you are bold, you can talk to the librarian. Tell them that you are a Sabbath keeper and you're a student of theology at Ambassador College. You probably will recognize that, depending on which one is on duty at the time. And ask to see the most ancient records. And they'll, you know, accompany you up to a private room, and from the safe we'll take out some of the letters that were written during this time by some of the Sabbath keepers. That's really all they have available. Of course, you can't read them because of the script in the English, but they have translations, if you please, almost needed, typed out by the side of them, and you can read some of the stories of people who were a part of the church in the 1600s and 1700s in that period of time. Very interesting to do. You can also visit the graveyard. Unfortunately now, Mr. Jimmy Franks, who has been the pastor of the Boston church now for about 8 years, is being transferred this summer, and it will take the new minister some time to learn the ropes. I have been intending to call him and be sure to tell him to spend some time with Mr. Franks to get all of these sites down so that he can tour guide any who might come through. Mr. Franks had to spend months searching around for some of these records, but he finally found in the graveyard, I think it's at Newport, where Stephen Mumford is buried, found the graveyard where some of these Sabbath keepers were buried. There are two major graveyards there. You may not find graveyards fascinating, but for this one occasion, it's very interesting. And you can barely make out the names on the tombstones. They're so old, just little bitty tombstones, about, you know, a foot and a half or so. But Stephen Mumford's, his wife, his children's tombstones are right there in the graveyard. And then in another cemetery, there are quite a number of tombstones, and rather large monuments, later built by the Seventh-day Baptists, to the honor of many of the Seventh-day preachers of these churches during the late 1600s, early 1700s. But Mr. Franks was well up on those things. There is a fairly decent Sabbatarian section at Brown University in Rhode Island as well. It was closed the day I went there, and I've never had a chance to go back. Interestingly enough, on the founding board of directors of Brown University, I think it was two, I'm not sure, but on the board were some Sabbath keepers. One of the governors of Rhode Island became a Sabbath keeper after his governorship. It's on his tombstone in the cemetery in Rhode Island. I've forgotten which one. Mr. Franks has all the information. I have pictures of it, which I'll try to show you next time. But you can at least get a lot of interesting information in some of those sources. The governor's wife, and I'll show you the pictures next time, and I don't recall the name now. The governor's wife was a Sabbath keeper, and he converted to Sabbath keeping, but it was after he was served his term as governor of Rhode Island. It's interesting that this happens in the colony of Rhode Island, because it is the one colony at this time that was established that did not have any one religion dominating it. It was, in fact, Rhode Island, established on the basis of religious freedom for all people. The other colonies were often very strict, but Rhode Island was established with the intent of being a colony of religious freedom. Interesting that it turned out to be the smallest, or certainly one of the smallest. I guess Delaware comes along a little later, smaller, but at that time, you know, there wasn't that much interest in religion, frankly, at this time or any other time. So we have the church now coming to America. The earliest man we know of, this doesn't mean that there weren't a few others, but the man with ability and organization and establishing churches, Stephen Mumford, arriving in 1664, establishing the first Sabbath-keeping church in 1671. Here's what Belcher writes of it. The seventh day in America, date from about the same period as our brethren in England began to organize regular churches. Mr. Stephen Mumford was one of the earliest among them. He came from England to Newport, Rhode Island in 1664 and, quote, brought with him the opinion of the Ten Commandments as they were delivered from Mount Sinai, that they were moral and immutable, and that it was an anti-Christian power which changed the Sabbath from the seventh day to the first day of the week. He associated much with the First Day Baptist Church in Newport, but soon won several members of that church to his view. They continued to walk with the church, however, for a time. In December 1671, they came to an open separation. Stephen Mumford, William Hiscox, Samuel Hubbard, Roger Baster, and three sisters entered into a church covenant together, thus forming the first Seventh-day Baptist church in America. William Hiscox, H-I-S-C-O-X, was chosen and ordained their pastor, which office he fulfilled until his death in 1704, when he was 66 years of age. In 1685, Mr. Hubbard wrote to Mr. Reeves of Jamaica that messengers were gone from their church to New London to declare that two or more of them who were of us were declined to Quakerism. I might say more, of whom be thou aware, for by their principles they will travel by land and sea to make disciples, and sorry ones too. Their names were John and James Rogers and one Donham. So here we have people who are kind of heretics, you know, causing people to go astray. From this beginning, says Bacchus, who wrote more than 60 years ago, proceeds a sect which has continued to this day, who from their chief leader has sometimes been called Rogerines. And people are going to call you by the name of the man, that's all there is to it. In their dialect and many other things, they've been like the first Quakers in this country, though they had retained the external use of baptism and the supper, and have been singular in refusing to use the means and medicine for their body. Their greatest zeal has been discovered in going from meeting to meeting and from town to town, as far as Norwich and Lebanon, and from the 114 and the other 21 miles to testify against hireling teachers and against keeping the first day of the week as the Sabbath, which they call the idol, with a capital I, idol Sabbath. And when the authorities have taken them up and fined them, therefore, having sometimes whipped them for refusing to pay it, they soon have published accounts of all such persecutions which has been keeping their sect alive. So again, it was not easy at that period of time. Continuing in Belcher's work, for more than 30 years after its organization, the Newport Church included nearly all persons observing the seventh day in the states of Rhode Island and Connecticut, and its pastors were accustomed to hold stated meetings in several different places for the better accommodation of widely scattered members. But in 1708, the brethren living in what was then called Westerly Rhode Island, that is, comprehending the southwestern corner of the state, thought best to form another society, According, they proceeded to organize the Hopkinton Church. These churches are still in existence to this day, or if they're not in existence, their successor church is in existence, and the original plot is an historic monument. And there are monuments all through this territory of the bridge where they baptized and the dates and the Sabbath-keeping plaques, just like you would see any historic monuments. They organized the Hopkinton Church, which had a succession of worthy pastors, became very numerous, built three meeting houses for the accommodation of the members in the different neighborhoods. At present, that's 1854, there are seven churches in Rhode Island, two in Connecticut, all in healthy condition of Sabbath keepers. Well, that's as far as I wanted to get today, because it's a rather natural breaking point. And then I'll begin next class. Stephanie, we need the slide set up for next class. Show you some slides of some of these things that you might see if you get to Rhode Island, and then we'll bring it up through what happened in the Sabbath-keeping movement up to the time Mr. Armstrong came in contact with it. The autobiography, of course, as I've mentioned already, takes you very clearly from there forward.